First thing I want to do is thank the committee, and most particularly Anne, that I have the pleasure and the honor of being here this weekend. So I do thank the committee for all they have done for me, and certainly for Anne, her hospitality since I've been here. You know, I have been to conferences in many, many states, and I tell you this, and I say it very sincerely, that I have never been to a conference anywhere in these United States that has the hospitality that the conferences in Texas have. Your hospitality is overwhelming. And also, I always look forward, you know, to coming to Texas. It seems like the speakers before me or the people that have been up to this podium had something to say about Al-Anon, you know. So I don't want to be left out entirely. I went to a conference in San Antonio a few years ago. And the Al-Anon ladies were the official hostesses of this conference. And they wore bright red t-shirts, and on them it said, Sisters of Perpetual Revenge. I tried to get one of those before I left, but they were all sold out. I have a friend who recently had a birthday. She isn't an AA friend. But she had a birthday, and her family had a birthday party for her. And she's the same age as I am, actually she's younger than I am, and she even has great-grandchildren. So they had a birthday party for her, and one of her little grandchildren looked up at her, and she said, Grandma, how old are you today? And Mara said, oh, well, I'm 60 years old today. And little granddaughter stood there, and she thought a minute, and she said, Oh, Grandma, you're so lucky you haven't died yet. And that's kind of the way I feel standing here this afternoon. I am so lucky, by God's grace, that I have not died yet, or that I am not dead. And I'm sure there are many of you out here that feel exactly the same way. You know, we are here, as far as I'm concerned. Each day has been a gift from a loving God. My name is Lynn Sears. Barry, Duschel, Williams, Deaver, Williams, Eliason. I am an alcoholic. This is the one thing that Anne and I have in common. I think, in fact, she may have had one more than I did. You know, if there was a loser within 100 miles, I could find him. You know, there are many descriptions of the alcoholic which I like, and one of them that I have always enjoyed is the alcoholic who can somehow reap disaster, you know, out of certain victory. You know, I was a crisis person, crisis alcoholic. You know, I lived from crises to crises. And if there wasn't a crisis, I could somehow go out and create a crisis. I'm sure some of you will be able to identify with that. And I can remember one Sunday afternoon, I took a razor blade and literally slashed both arms and slashed my abdomen. I have scars, still have scars in my arms and my abdomen. Then I turned over the furniture in the living room. Just made a ridiculous looking mess in the house. And then I called the police department and I told them that my house had been broken into, someone was trying to rob me, and in the process had stabbed me. So here came the police department, the fire department, you know, the emergency vehicles pulling up in front of my house. And here came the policeman inside to sit, and they sat down to take this report. I just imagine what must have gone through their head as I was, you know, telling them this story of agony, you know, all these slashes on my arms and my abdomen. But, you know, even sicker than that, I guess, is the fact that I actually thought they would believe me. Now, if there's any one of you out here that is saying, my heavens, how could she possibly do a thing like that? Then you're obviously not an alcoholic. So, as I said, I would create crises where there were none. You know, I had one of the first AA women friends that I had sat me down and she said, Lynn, You can find many things in this program. And for those of you who are new, I would tell you exactly the same thing that she told me. She said, you know, you can find many things in this program. You can find a new husband. You can find a new wife. You can find a new girlfriend, a new boyfriend. You can probably find a live-in. She said, you can find a new job. You can probably find a house or some place to live if you no longer have a place to live. She said, you can probably find someone that will feed you, buy you a meal if you're hungry, or advance you $5 or $6, you know, if you're totally broke. But she said, you'll also find, she said, sobriety here. And she said, I suggest right now you decide what is your priority, and it better be sobriety. She went on to say, you know, our very existence, our very lives depend upon our spiritual growth. I'm not sure that I totally understood that at the time. I certainly do now. But she said there are going to be many times, she said, in this program, she said, where you're once again going to feel that hole in your gut with the wind roaring through. And she said, when that happens, she said, I want you to step back and I want you to look at one thing and one thing only. And that is your relationship with God. Because therein lies the problem, and therein lies the answer. She said, the relationship between two people is sexuality. And the relationship between the alcoholic and God is spirituality. She said, I suggest you never get the two confused. Because I immediately went out and got the two confused. Now, speaking of sexuality, I never will forget first time I walked into York Street, and York Street is one of very large, well-known AA facilities in Denver. Walked into York Street, if you will, on my own power. When I got sober, you know, the micro mini skirt was in vogue, and white boots. So as soon as I was physically able, I went out and I bought myself a bright red micro mini skirt and a pair of white boots, and I went off to York Street. Now, I walked in, I held my head high in all my feminine glory, and I walked by VPR in all my feminine glory. Now, none of you seem to pick up on that. Don't any of your groups here in Abilene have a VPR? That surprises me. Dead Pecker Row. I thought all AA facilities had a VPR.
That's not funny.
But I said, I held my head high, and I walked by VPR. I'm not kidding you. There are some men that were sitting there when I came in the program that are still sitting there today. But I walked by those men on DPR, and I walked into the coffee shop, as I said, in my bright red micro mini skirt and my white boots. It didn't seem to matter to me at that time that my head had been shaved, that half of my right side was bandaged, that my left hand was in a cast, that my left side visibly drug as I walked. It didn't seem to matter that I was still covered with wine sores. Actually, what I looked like was a horse that had been ridden hard and put away wet. But you see, as I stood there, the only thing that came across my mind was the fact that I was sober, and I had come a long, long ways, you know, from dead. You know, when I first got here again, there seemed to be a lot of interest. And I think there still is today, you know, in our marital status. And I can remember when I first got here, I told you all that I was currently between husbands. And then a certain length of time passed, and that didn't seem appropriate anymore. So I quickly changed it to, well, I'm currently between boyfriends. Then that didn't seem to be appropriate after a few years. So now I just simply tell you that I am between menopause and senility. You know, actually, we alcoholics, you know, we don't get married, we take hostages. and I do have a public announcement to make at this time. I am currently looking for a new hostage. You know, my biological clock is ticking, you know. But I have decided, you know, that perhaps it would be a little bit better, you know, maybe some short-term relationships, especially if you will kiss and tell, because I need all the publicity I can get. I almost forgot one thing, and that's I do know that I am in Texas, and you all do always open by telling your sobriety date. And my sobriety date is May 3rd of 1970. I have 21 years and some months of sobriety. And for this, I am eternally grateful. You know, I have always gotten very nervous standing behind this podium. I'm very serious about that. I mean, my stomach is just churns. In fact, I was telling Anne before the meeting, I said, I can go to the bathroom, you know, 2 minutes before this meeting starts. And I can stand up here and within 5 minutes I have to go again. So I've often thought about putting in, you know, an indwelling catheter, you know, and a bowel along my leg. That might solve that problem. But, you know, there was something happened as I stood behind this podium 3 years ago. And I didn't think after that experience that I would ever stand behind this podium again. I was at a conference in New York. And when I finally sat down, I was in a cold sweat. I mean, the cold sweat was just pouring off of me. Now, what had happened during that hour and 15 minutes, whatever length of time it was that I stood there, it was like my mind was clicking on and off. Like I was having one micro mini blackout after another. And I sat down, I didn't understand, you know, what was happening, what had happened to me that hour. I mean, I had had some symptoms somewhat like this before this particular conference. I was having very severe headaches. But that hour, when I sat down, as I said, I was just in a cold sweat. I thought, I will never, never stand behind this podium again. I will never, I can't. What has happened to me? You know, I became the kind of patient, or I should say, wasn't a patient, a person that I have always somewhat criticized. And that's the patient there that says, oh, I'm afraid to go to the doctor. I'm afraid what they might tell me, so they don't go. But I knew when I got home from that conference that just very definitely was something wrong. But I kept putting it to the back of my mind. I truly was. I truly did become one of those persons that did not want to go to the doctor because I did not want to know what he might tell me. I continued to have symptoms. I lost a half a day. That was hard to ignore, a whole half a day. But then I tell you the thing that happened that really cinched it. I was getting ready for bed one night, and I had on 2 pairs of underwear. I couldn't remember putting the first pair of underwear on, much less the second pair of underwear. And I thought, there's something wrong here. So I finally did take myself to the doctor, and to make a very long story short, after many tests and scans, etc., they found out that I am an epileptic, a form of epilepsy. And I didn't realize until this time that there are so many different forms of epilepsy. There's something like 25 different forms of epilepsy. Most of us think about epilepsy as being the grand mal seizure. That's just one form of epilepsy. I had the type of epilepsy the doctor explained to me where I was probably having, you know, 12 to 14 seizures a day. It truly was a kind of epilepsy. It was kind of like being in a mini blackout. And I swear to you, I must have had all 14 behind that podium that day in New York. So this was almost harder for me to accept, I think, than alcoholism. Alcoholism was hard for me to accept. But I grew up in a generation that had anything, you know, wrong with their head up here. And so that's kind of hard for me to accept. And interestingly enough, the doctor felt that probably 95% of the reason why at this late age that I developed epilepsy was probably due to the many, many very serious head injuries I've had during my drinking career and 20 years of very serious alcoholic drinking. Might have been some other factors into it, but that was the primary reason after all of these years. They also felt they'd probably had it for some time, but took this long for the symptoms to manifest themselves to the point where I actually decided there was something wrong. So to stand behind here again is very frightening to me. I'm more nervous, as I said, I think, than the first time I got behind this podium. So I hope you will understand that. But, you know, I find it kind of a handy excuse, really. Because, you know, if I forget something, I've got epilepsy. So if I get confused up here, if I forget something and back off and tell you, oh, I meant to tell you this and I forgot, you'll understand. You know, I was an unwanted child, you know, of promiscuous sex. And at that particular time, I mean, this type of child, or children born of this type of relationship, were not as easily accepted as they are today. My mother, my biological mother, immediately gave me away, and the young couple who took me, who adopted me, were a young couple from Iowa that apparently for some reason could not have children of their own. I did not know why. You know, today we call these babies, you know, throwaway babies. So I was a throwaway baby, and this couple caught me. And from the very beginning, my earliest memory is I felt different. You know, the man who spoke last night talked about always feeling different, always feeling like you're on the outside of the circle, looking in. Or, oh, how you want to be on the inside of that circle, but you don't know how to get there. I did not know that I was an adopted child, much less that I was an illegitimate child. My parents, for some reason, chose not to tell me. So I started to school, and I think it was in about third grade, some child, you know, children can be so cruel, some child called me a very dirty name. At least in my child's mind, it was a very dirty name. I didn't know what it meant, but it had to be something dirty. The teacher, when she found out what had happened, sent me home, and she said, Lynn, well, I was called Marilyn then, go home and tell your mother what has happened. I remember going home that day and telling her what had happened, and oh, the anguish that woman must have suffered that day. And I really don't remember anything she told me outside of the fact that I was different. You know, I was now justified in my feelings. I was indeed different. Well, as I said, you know, children can be so cruel. This is a very small town. And so any time anyone wanted to get to me, you know, and children, they always had a real pleasant name that they could call me. And I grew up with a tremendous amount of anger. I was angry towards this woman who had borne me and then just given me away. I was angry towards this nameless, faceless man who had bothered me. I was angry towards this small town that somehow would not let me forget that I was different, although they used other names. And I even became angry at my adopted parents, my adopted mother, bless her heart, because she took on a very, very anxious attitude about me, and especially when I grew old enough to start dating. Just so much show you how angry I became as a child. I tried to commit suicide for the first time at the age of 8. You know, I knew nothing about death. I simply did not like living. It just hurt too much. But I said, my mother's got a very anxious attitude as I reached my teens and I started to date. And she said, when you go out, she said, you must not sit in parked cars. You must not let a boy touch you. I'm not sure I really understood all that she was saying or inferring. You must come immediately home after a date. I want to ask her more because I didn't quite understand what she was driving at. You see, I think that she probably thought, you know, like mother, like daughter type of syndrome. And I remember one night I came home later than I should have. I mean, I had a curfew and I had better be there because if I was sitting out in the car, and we called it necking in those days, if I was sitting out in the car and I was even 5 minutes late, you know, the lights would go on the porch and she would be at the door. But this particular night, I was late getting home, and I mean, I got out of that car and my mother wasn't standing at the door. I got into the living room and she was pacing up and down the floor in an obvious rage. And she said, where have you been? What did you let that boy do to you? She said, don't you know that that's where babies like you come from? And until the day that this woman died, and she died when I was quite young, blessed at heart, I never quite forgot that. You see, now this pronouncement about me wasn't just something I had dreamed up. It wasn't just something that I had imagined. Now it was for real, as far as I was concerned. So you see, I sought identity. I sought answers to my frustration in men and marriage. And it didn't work. It didn't work. You see, there was never enough of whatever it was I was looking for. You see, I didn't know until I came to this program that what it was I was looking for could only be found, you know, deep inside. You see, my thinking went like this. I would get married, and my husband would make me happy. My husband would give me an identity. My husband would give me the constant assurance of love. He would give me security. Well, no human being can live up to that type of expectation. They didn't. And yet I continue to believe they should. But I said it didn't work. Men and marriage simply did not work. The first time I drank, I got drunk. I happen to believe that there are those who are born alcoholic or were born without the mechanism that can metabolize alcohol properly. I happen to believe that I was born alcoholic. But the first time I drank, I got drunk. And I don't recall ever drinking, you know, without getting drunk. I still to this day cannot conceive of anyone who can sit down with a drink. That's just, you know, that's totally beyond my conception. But this was the golden elixir that I had been looking for. This was the golden elixir, alcohol. It did for me, you know, all the things that I could not seem to do for myself. It did all the things for me that husbands, relationships couldn't seem to do for me. My first drinking ended in a drunk, and I don't recall in all the years I drank, which was something like 23 years, that I ever drank without getting drunk. My first episode of drinking, which as I said ended in a drunk, also ended in an automobile accident. And interestingly enough, some 23, 24 years later, my alcoholism was to reach its peak, you know, reach its peak after an automobile accident or because of an automobile accident. Well, I was also in the medical field. I still am, as a matter of fact. And I put together tremendous bag of tricks, if you will, because I had the knowledge and I had the availability to do these things. You know, back then, some of you who have been around for a while and are familiar with the medical profession know this to be true. At that time, detail men would come around and they would leave piles of pills on your desk, free samples. Or they would come in, they'd not only leave them on our desk, they would pile them up in the doctor's office. Everything but hard narcotics was sent through the mail as samples. And man, I tried them all. But you see, by this time, I did have that hole in my gut, and the wind was blowing through. And I needed something to somehow fill that hole, if I could just find the perfect combination. And as I said, I was in a perfect situation to do this. As I said, I tried everything that was available to try. And as I said, and what the detail men did not leave on our desk was sent through the mail. The mailman would come in the same thing every day, empty out a bag full of samples. You know, most people read their mail. I ate mine. But the availability was there. You know, drug dealers would have starved to death back then. And we literally had a closet full of a set of free samples. I can remember one time, just to show you what my thinking was, I remember one time I took a whole bunch of pills for gout. Now, I didn't have gout, but my thinking was like this. Well, true, I don't have gout, but someday I may have gout, and maybe this will help. Well, my routine became very established. You know, it was amphetamines, what they call uppers, amphetamines all day long. It was scotch in the evening, and then it was a handful of barbiturates. you know, so I could go to bed and perhaps catch a few hours of sleep. And as I said, I put together a tremendous bag of tricks. Because you see, I got to the point where I was drinking so much and taking so many pills and trying so hard, you know, to act normal, you know. But every once in a while, I'd get to the point where I'd have to have a little bit more rest and a little bit maybe harder drugs to get me through a particular bad time. So best way to do that was, you know, to get yourself admitted to the hospital. Now, it wouldn't work today, but get yourself admitted to the hospital. So I had, as I said, put together some interesting ideas. Now, one of the things that I particularly liked is what I call my kidney stone paper. You see, I had acquired a kidney stone that someone else had passed. And I learned where to put this kidney stone, you know, right on my back. Keep in mind I was in the medical field. On my back, where when the x-ray was taken, you know, of my abdomen, sure enough, there was that kidney stone. And I knew just exactly how much blood to put in my urine. So when they could confirm the diagnosis with, you know, with the urinalysis. So they would put me to bed until I passed my kidney stone. Now, those of you who have actually had a kidney stone, I never have, but those of you who have actually had a kidney stone, it's intense pain. It truly, truly is intense pain. So they would give me, you know, narcotics for the pain. And I could, you know, I would feed upon this for about 3 weeks, I mean 3 days. Then once again, I would pass my kidney stone, now I'm ready to go back out and face that cruel world again. I never will forget the day that I lost that kidney stone. You know, nothing else seemed to quite, you know, come up to that. But, you know, not all of my escapades, if you will, I would deliberately fall down flights of stairs. Periodically, I would go in the bathroom, open the cupboards, and empty out the bottles of pills. It didn't make any difference to me what it was. Empty them out. But I must tell you that not all of these escapades were planned and well orchestrated. For example, there was the night I caught my pubic hair on fire. You know, I can assure you, it could happen to any one of you. But I was at this party, and I was very drunk, and I went into the bathroom, and I sat down. Now, I always light a cigarette, you know, when I go to the bathroom. You know, I still do that today. Well, I'm concentrating on one thing and one thing only, and that's to stay on that toilet. You can falling off and falling on the floor. So I smoke my cigarette. I finish what I was doing. I took some toilet paper and I dropped it between, usually dropped it between my legs. But unfortunately, it did not go into the water. It just kind of sat there, you know. It sat there. I didn't know that. Now I took my cigarette. I dropped it between my legs. I want you to know, I had a burning bush experience long before I came to AA. But it all wasn't fun and games, ladies and gentlemen. I have forgotten, perhaps because I choose to forget, how many times I was beaten, how many times I was raped. I will never forget the Christmas Eve that I was pulled all the way up a full flight of stairs by my hair, beaten and raped on a Christmas Eve. And you know, the sad part of this is, all of these years, some way I thought I deserved this. This was what I deserved. No, babe, I did not deserve this. No, I did not deserve this. But you see, I didn't know I could say, I didn't know I had any rights left. You know, I had such guilt, such tremendous guilt for the way my life was going. Anytime any of these things would happen, I just automatically thought, well, you know, I deserved. No, I did not. Now, added to this, you know, in fact, I was, you know, for gentlemen, I was one of those buzzsaws, you know, that used to sit on the end of the bar, that at 2 o'clock in the morning look absolutely ravishing to one of you. I imagine there's a few of you here this weekend. I thought I recognized one or two. But you see, I thought, you know, this would sit on that bar till 2 o'clock, and you know, I would become ravishing to whoever was on the other end of the bar. But ladies and gentlemen, I know that these things go on today as well as they went on then. And the thing that terrifies me today, for those of you who are still drinking, those of us who are still out there drinking, perhaps something even more frightening, you know, than our alcoholism, our addiction, the beatings, the rapes. It's called AIDS. And it terrifies me when I think of how I was at that particular time. And it terrifies me to think of those of us today who are out there drinking, or out there drinking, who do become ravishing, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning. But they said I was on a roller coaster going down at a fast rate of speed because my diet was amphetamine, scotch, and barbiturates. I was losing my sanity, and I knew I was losing my sanity. Someone, I think it was, this gentleman spoke today, the Al-Anon, he was talking about how he could not recognize his father, you know, as being an alcoholic. Well, here I am in the medical profession, and for some reason I could not figure out what was wrong with me. I just knew I was going crazy. I was losing weight. My God, I got below 100 pounds. I was sick. I knew I was losing my mind, but I didn't know what was wrong with me. You see, everyone I knew drank. Everyone took pills. In fact, I furnished them with pills. So I didn't know what was wrong with me. So one night, without one rational brain cell left in my head, I ran out of the house. It was snowing. I was barefooted. All I had on was just a kind of a little sleeveless dress. I broke into a doctor's office. I took 100 sleeping tablets. I'm talking about secondals. 100 sleeping tablets, and I lay down to die. You know, that's enough to kill 6 horses. And I lay down to die, and I did it in such a manner that I knew no one would find me for at least 8 hours. When I came to several weeks later, I could not believe that some way, somehow, someone could take this many sleeping tablets and live. You know, we have a very tenacious God. He holds on to us until we finally are able to get to this program. Oh, what a tenacious God we have. Well, after I recovered medically, I was put into my first psychiatric hospital. Now, I was there several months. Now, this was a very modern psychiatric hospital. We had doctors there that were up on the latest treatment of this type of thing. You see, they realized and they knew that alcoholism was nothing more than a thorazine deficiency. So I would join this little group, you know, 3 times a day. You know, that typical thorazine shuffle, you know, to get my thorazine. And I was there for some time. Now, during this particular period of time, and I would mention to you that during one of my marriages, I had 2 beautiful, beautiful sons, Patrick and Michael. It was during this period of time I was in the psychiatric hospital that the courts decided that I was no longer a fit mother, and my children were taken from me. We were to be separated 5 years. You know, I have known women in this program who have had their children taken from them for one reason or another. I do not know of anything more devastating for a woman than to have her children taken from her because she is unfit. I was finally released from that hospital and started down a path that was probably the most miserable time of my life. But I tried to figure out what's wrong and what is happening to me. Well, obviously it was the man I was married to. So I divorced him. And I quickly found another one. Now, this one was my dream. He was a living, breathing, drinking alcoholic. And I want to tell you folks right here and now, the couple who vomits together does not necessarily stay together. And so it was with David and I. He was an aerospace physicist. He made lots of money, bought us a beautiful house, and he bought me a convertible, a Mustang convertible. Well, my oldest son, Michael, had run away several times trying to come back to me. We'd have to go back to court, and finally it was decided that Michael could stay with this crazy woman if that's what he wanted. So I never will forget, it was a beautiful, beautiful Sunday afternoon, February 9th. And the kind of Sunday afternoons that we can have in Denver. It can snow one day, you know, in Denver, and the next day the temperature can be up in the 70s. Beautiful day. Michael was there. They'd finally gotten back to live with me. Only been there a couple of months. So Michael and I decided that we would go for a ride in my new convertible. So we put the top down on the convertible, and we went for a ride. Now, I had reached the point in my drinking where I was never sober at this point. Never sober. We stopped to do some visiting. Of course, I had to have a few drinks while I was there, you know, drinks for the road. And Michael and I started home, but we never made it. Having had much too much to drink, because my senses dulled because of the alcohol, I was going much too fast on one of our freeways. And a car pulled directly in front of me who had planned on making an exit and chose otherwise. So rather than to rear end this car at the fast rate of speed that I was going, I chose to make a sharp cut into the left lane. I immediately lost control of my car, and Michael and I went over three times in open convertible. The only thing that saved our lives that night, I went over three times in open convertible. The only thing that saved our lives that night was the fact that Michael had his seatbelt on, and I didn't. And somehow, when the car started over, Michael was thrown forward, and my body was thrown over him, my hips wedged under the steering wheel. So I took the brunt of the accident, thank God. The third time over, I was thrown from the car, and the car was on top of me. You know, if the injuries that I sustained in that accident had happened to my son instead of me, I could never have accepted that. Never. You see, the thing I did not know at that time was that there was a loving God who was with us even in those seconds of that accident. My husband, incidentally, I was pronounced dead at the scene of that accident. My husband was called to Denver General Hospital to identify this very mangled piece of humanity. I was to spend many, many hours in surgery and many weeks, you know, unconscious. And when I did regain consciousness, I came to a very grim, grim reality. The entire right side of my face was gone. There's nothing left. My right side of my head had been opened up. Half of my left hand was gone. They might have to amputate the entire hand. I had a spinal cord injury. I might never walk again. Now, if I had been angry as a child growing up, it was nothing compared to the anger that I felt now. What kind of a sadistic God is this? Because you see, David, I think he did not know, and at that time the doctors did not know whether I would ever be a productive human being again or not. And David in his alcoholism, believe me, it took a long time for me to understand this. David, I think, sobered up only long enough to pack his bags and file for divorce. You know, if I had ever needed another human being in my life, I needed David then, and David was gone. And I said, I was so angry at God. How, God, could you do this? Why didn't you let me die in that accident? Why didn't you let me die? The thing that David said that David knew that I didn't momentarily know was that I might never be a productive human being again or not. In the next 2 years, I made 16 trips to surgery while they slowly put me back together again. The major reconstruction of my face wasn't until 9 months after the accident. And initially, all they did was just simply strip my legs of the skin graft and just covered up my face. After about 3 months, that first visitation, 3 months, they sent me home to, you know, just have a little bit of time at home before they started on the next set of surgeries. Now, here I am. As I said, my head has been shaved, incidentally, kept it shaved, you know, off and on for 2 years. Here I am, I can hardly walk. I can't use my left hand. I can't, as I said, I can hardly walk. And somehow I managed to get in the car, and I went to the nearest bar, and I sat at that bar and got drunk. And she knew there wasn't anyone thought me ravishing at 2 a.m. that morning. For some way, some reason, they knew how drunk I was. They also knew how sick I was. But somehow they put me in my car. They headed in the right direction. They said, "You think you can make it home?" I said, "No problem." Well, I didn't make it all the way home. I apparently made it only within a block of home. I don't remember too much of this, but I got out of the car and trying to find, I guess, my house. I lived in a condominium, and so they all looked alike. And I passed out in a snowbank, a very dirty, dirty snowbank. The next morning, someone came along, and here I am, you know, passed out in the snowbank. And he literally took me by the hand. He led me around, knocking on doors. "Do you know her? Do you have any idea where she belongs?" And that night, they put me back in the hospital because all of this surgery that they had done had to be done over again. Because laying in that snowbank all night, you know, all that became infected, and all that had to be done over again. There's one thing I would like to backtrack just a minute. If you can understand, it hits my epilepsy. There was something I wanted to tell you I forgot. But the first time, as I said, the first time the bandages came off, they took the bandages off of my hand first. And I can remember looking at my hand, and I can remember crying all day. But you see, up to that point, I had been a classical pianist. And I knew that I would never be a classical pianist again. So when the bandages came off my face, you know, it was almost semi, you know, semi-dramatic, semi-whatever. It didn't seem to matter as much. But going back to this, it all had to be replaced. So it came about 9 months after the accident. They put me back in the hospital now to construct my face. And the way they were going to do this was to literally grow my arm to my face, which they did. They grew my arm to my face. They operated on my left hand again, and then they put this entire production in a body cast. They propped me up on pillows, and there I sat for 6 weeks for the transplant to take. I had a very wise doctor at that time. You know, he knew I was a very sick alcoholic. He certainly knew that this was not the time to take me off with alcohol. So between the time that accident happened and going back in the hospital 9 months later, I drank now every day I drank. I drank now to die. So he didn't try to take me off the alcohol. I was given alcohol in that hospital. Every 3 hours, one is given medication. I also had friends that brought bottles into me. And you say that we alcoholics have no willpower? Here I am in a body cast. My arm is sewn to my face. This hand is in a cast. And I managed to smoke and drink the entire time I was there. Now, I wasn't a particularly popular patient because I did catch my bed on fire one night. And I can still remember waking up and seeing this fireman in his full regalia. Oh, I was dreading for my doctor to come in that morning and all. He said, "She didn't understand a little bit of a problem last night." Well, I never had trouble getting visitors to bring me booze, bring me alcohol. Because, you see, they would take one look at me and they'd think, "Well, this is an act of mercy," and off they would go to the and bring me back a bottle. So one day there was a woman came into that ward, and her name was Libby. And Libby and I knew she liked me. We had an instant rapport, if you will. And here her husband, Gordon, came in every day to visit. And yet somehow I could not talk Gordon into bringing me in a bottle of alcohol. And I couldn't understand this. My God, let me see you. This is an act of mercy. But you see, the thing I did not know was that Libby and Gordon were alcoholics. At that time, they had been in the program and sober for 20 years. I didn't know that. Well, Libby got well, she went home. Now, she went back to her AA group, and she told them about this woman at St. Joe's Hospital who was going through all of this insane surgery. But even more important than that, she was able to see through the bandages, see through the cast, and she saw the sick alcoholic woman that was underneath. So she told her group about this sick alcoholic woman going through all of this insane surgery, and this group decided to pray for this sick alcoholic woman at St. Joe's Hospital. Well, I was finally allowed to go home. They cut my arm down. I was finally allowed to go home because it was getting very close to the holidays. I was back, I was allowed to go home about 3 days before Thanksgiving. The very next day I was back in the hospital again, this time tied down in alcoholic coma. Passed that, they sent me home again. Now it is Thanksgiving Eve. Now there was nothing in that house to eat. I was very, very, getting very, very sick. I needed a drink. And I can remember sometime during the night waking up, and there I am, you know, in laying there in my own blood, in my own vomit, you know, in my own urine. And I knew I was going to die. There was no doubt in my mind about it. And this is what I had wanted. That is death on the installment plan. There had to be a better way to die than this. But somehow I managed to make it to a phone, and I called a friend who happened to know a lady in AA. And this lady from AA called me. And I can't remember much of what she said to me, and I remember what I said to her, though. I said, well, you've got to get somebody here to help me by 10 o'clock, because at 10 o'clock the liquor store opens, and I've got to be there if I have to call. I need to get I'm very, very sick. So I got to hang up in order to get you help. I beg you not to hang up, because at this point, you know, she was my only connection with reality. So I got to hang up, and I said, what do I do in the meantime? She said, you'll pray. Pray? You're kidding. She said, I don't care if you have to pray, pretend you are praying, you will pray. And she hung up the phone. And I still remember seeing this. I thought, well, she did tell me that I could pretend I was praying, and so I never will forget my prayer. I said, dear God, if you're up there, which I seriously doubt, this is your last chance. You know, if you don't help me now, I'm checking out. And I never will forget those next few minutes, and it's still today, it's very hard to put into words. But my dream filled with a strength, it filled with a power, it filled with a radiance. And I can still remember it. And most days, as I think I knew them, I reached out my hand and I know I touched the hand of God. God in His omnipotence, God in His unending love, His mercy, His compassion, had reached down to my world of pain and touched me. I didn't know what was going to happen, but somehow I knew I was going to be all right. At 10 o'clock that morning, two AA people came, and they spent the day with me. It was a couple, young couple, Thanksgiving Day, and they spent the entire day with me in trying to nurse this alcoholic who was so sick, trying to talk to my son, who was very, very angry, didn't understand what was going on. And towards evening, Bruce said, Lynn, do you think you could make a full meeting? I said, oh, God, at this point, I wouldn't have done anything this man asked because I knew he was trying to save my life. He took me out of the kitchen, I still remember, poured orange juice and honey down my throat, just some of it would stay. I said, okay, Bruce, I'll go. He said, well, you know, Aunt Ruth, I was planning on meeting tonight, but she said, I'm going to get on the phone, I will call all of my group, and we'll have a meeting tonight. So he did, he used my phone, he called everyone in his group, and he said, dang, we have to have a meeting tonight, I've got a real one here. So the group had a meeting that night. Now I want you to think for a minute. Denver is a very large city. There were AA groups very close to my home. At that time I lived out in the foothills of the mountains. For some reason, Bruce took me to a group there over in the north part of the city, the northeast part of the city. It was a group called Mountain View. And it was to be realized that night before it was over, that this was the lady that this group had prayed for some 3 months before. The miracles of God working in our lives, working in the lives of one alcoholic, reaching out their hand, you know, to touch the life of another. Oh, God. What miracles we see in this book. What miracles. And I remember sometime later I said to Bruce, do you always carry orange juice and honey with you? He said, why? Never, why? I said, my God, I don't have any orange juice and honey in my kitchen. I've never bought honey, and I certainly didn't have any orange juice. He said, well, then you've got nothing to tell you. Well, I don't question that today. I don't question that today, because each one of us in this room is a miracle that we really can't explain. But it took me to that meeting, and he knew that he was going to have help with this one. So he volunteered the services of another gentleman by the name of George. Now, George only had 6 months of sobriety at the time, but he used to be my co-sponsor. And these two men, do you talk about 90 meetings in 90 days? One of these men was at my door every night. Ready? I'm going to a meeting. And they would take me to a meeting because I could not physically take myself. And I'd go to these meetings and I would sit there and wait for my turn to talk. And all I could talk about was my problems. All I could talk about. I had a bunch. And I could remember going before I would go to a meeting, I would oftentimes sit down and I would write out my problems. So when it came my turn to talk, I wouldn't forget any of them, you know. And here's George sitting over there, and I tell you my problems, and he says, Lynn, things will get better. Next night, same thing, all over again, you know, I would tell you my problems. And it's good, big problems. How could I possibly get sober if my husband did not come back and take care of me? I was not able to work. How could he come, unless he came back to take care of me? How could I get sober if my youngest son did not come back into my life? How could I get sober until all this surgery was finished? I still had a year of surgery to go through after I came to this program. So I had a bunch of problems. George would just sit there, he had a sickening smile on his face. Lynn, things will get better. One night I had taken it for the last time. I told you my problems. George, once more, again, things will get better. I stood up at that meeting and I said, George, if you ever, ever, ever tell me again that things are going to get better, I'm going to kick you right in the nuts. Now they still talk about that night. In fact, every time after all these years, I see George and he'll still go. But they said, things did not get better. Only incidentally, here's George with 6 months of sobriety, taking care of me, and that man never drank again. He was so busy taking care of me, he stayed sober. You know, he has never thanked me even once for that. Well, I came to your meetings, and I listened, but I did not hear. And 4 months after I got here, I went out and I drank again for one more disastrous month. I said, now when I came back, perhaps I had enough constructive brain damage to listen. No human power could relieve my alcoholism. God could and would if he were sovereign. I heard this over and over and over again. God could and would if he were sovereign. Where do you find God? I knew the first thing I had to do was find God. You see, we are good forgetters, you know. And somehow I'd kind of forgotten that fantastic experience in that room of bedroom of mine on Thanksgiving morning. I don't know, perhaps I wasn't willing to identify then. So where do you find God? Now, I know there are many new people here that perhaps are at this point in their program. Where do you find God? Well, a very smart man told me, God is not lost. You don't have to find him. So, God is not lost. And we became lost, but God is not lost. So I accepted the fact that God is, as far as I got. You know, our big book tells us, we reach a point where we must face this head on. Either God is or he is not. God is everything or he is nothing. And I've often wondered why, after I'd been in the program for a while, and I truly was trying to work these steps, did I go out and drink again? I know that it's important that I knew these things. I had to know. And I came to a realization then, as I strongly believe it then, and I strongly believe it now, which I pass on to you for your use if you can use it. Keep in mind, what I say up here are my opinions and my opinions only. If you can't reconcile it with a big book, I've told that many times, then leave it where you found it. But, okay, God is. He is. He's not lost. And I felt a lot of hope in these rooms. How can you look out here and see all of these smiling, sober faces and not feel hope? Maybe I, too, can get sober. But hope is of the future. Hope is always something that we hope for in the future. I needed something now. I needed to know how now. Again, I refer back, I think, to the gentleman this morning. I need to know something, find out something now, what I could do about the problem that was harassing me now. What can I do now? Well, that is called faith. But I'm sorry, I wasn't ready for that. I was not ready for that. But you know, our second step says this to us, came to believe. And too often I think we hurry over this step. We're so anxious to get to that third step, but we make that decision, you know, to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God if we understand it, before we came to believe. You know, would you take a paycheck that you've worked very hard for a month and turn it over to a complete stranger? Say, here's my paycheck. I know that I'm going to turn it over to you, and you make the decision as to what is to be done with this paycheck for my life. No, you're not going to do that. No. And someone told me a story I've never forgotten. There was this mountain man. He was a hermit living up in the mountains, and one day he decided to come down and visit. And it was a very hot day, and he and I sat in my living room, and the room got very warm. And I got up, and I went over to my thermostat, and I turned it down. And the room got very cool. Oh, was he impressed. He was so impressed. The room got a little warmer, and once again, I got up, I went over to my thermostat, I turned it down, the room got cooler again. Finally, he said, what is that box you have on the wall? I said, well, that's a thermostat. And exactly, he said, where do I buy one? I told him, oh, you could probably find one at any hardware store. So he left, went to a hardware store, and he bought a thermostat. Went back up to his cabin, and he nailed it on the wall. Man, he went to bed, and he was really looking forward to that next day, because he was going to sit in his rocking chair, he was going to drink his coffee, and he was going to stay cool all day, because it was hot out. The next morning, he got up, and he sat in his rocking chair, he started to walk, and the room started to get hot, his cabin. He smiled, got up, and he turned the thermostat down. He went back, and he sat down in his chair, he started to rock again. But the room didn't get any cooler. He didn't understand this. Three times he went over to that box on the wall and turned it down. But the room did not get any cooler. In fact, it got hotter. So he finally went over there and in total frustration beat that box on the wall. You see, the thing he did not realize was that box had to be connected to the power source. And our power source is God. I call my higher power God. That power source is God. All right, so now I found God because he isn't lost. I have hope because I see it in your faces. Now, this also tells me that, okay, somehow I've got to realize this hope I have here has to make that very short journey to here or connect it to the power source in order to make the connection that I need to make in this program to stay sober. It's that connection, that feeling we have right here. That is faith. Where do I find it? How do I get faith? How do I find faith? Well, I've got news for you, some of the most beautiful news I've heard in a long time. You know, God in his big book has a lot of promises, too. You know, just like our big book and all of our promises. In fact, you know, most of the promises in our big book are based on God's promises, you know, from his big book. And one of God's promises is this, and please, if you take nothing else away from what I've had to say today, please take this with you. One of God's promises is this. He who was poor, he gave great faith. He gave great faith. Is there any other group of people that are any more poor, any more devastatingly poor, and the very sick alcoholics and addicts that we once were, and still may be today? You don't, what I'm saying to you is you don't have to go out there searching. He is giving it to us. He gave. It didn't say we had to go look for it. He didn't say, now if you stay sober 90 days, I will give you this. He gave it to us. It is there. All we have to do is take it. I'm sure if I offered you a $100 bill, you would not hesitate to take it. You would not question it. You would take it, and you would utilize it. Take what God has promised us. Faith and none of it. And that to me was one of the most beautiful things that happened in my life when I realized that now I had the hope. Now I had the faith because it was a gift. I did not have to go out there and work for it. It was a gift. You know, have any of you ever wondered, when you're talking this program, you know, about being a 24-hour program, you know, a day at a time, I didn't understand that for a long time. You know, everything that we hear in this program, especially some of the little cliches, they had original meanings, incidentally, but not necessarily the meanings that we use today. So where did this come from, this 24 hours a day? How can I stay sober 24 hours a day, one day at a time? There's also a very simple answer to that. Just going back to God's book. He has a promise in there. It's a promise he has given to us. And it says that each morning, every morning when we get up, and our feet hit the floor, he gives a brand new supply of compassion, of love, of strength. All of that we need. And it's brand new every morning. Every morning it's a fresh supply. It isn't though he gives us some and we use it and it runs out. That never happens. Every 24 hours he gives us, he renews, if you will, his compassion, his love, his healing in our lives. All of that was beautiful, beautiful news to me when I heard it. He not only gives us the faith that we need, he gives it to us. But each day he gives us that supply we need to get us through that 24-hour period. And during those months I spent in the hospital, there was one thing I learned, and that was, as bad as it was, there was never a day that God put more on my shoulders than I could handle. There were some days when the pain was so severe, I didn't think it was possible to get through that 24 hours. But somehow, I did. He will never give us any more in any 24-hour period than we can handle. For those of you who are new, he will keep you sober 24 hours today. He's giving you that promise this morning. You will stay sober. There were times I literally had to sit on my hands, and I didn't think in terms of 24 hours a day. I thought of 5 minutes at a time. You know, there weren't any detox centers then. There weren't any halfway houses. We were totally dependent upon one another. We were totally dependent upon one another, the meetings and the big books, and the telephone calls to one another. I mean, I used to pick up that phone and call at the weirdest times. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, I'd be terrified. And I don't recall an AA person ever being angry because I had called at that hour of the morning. I don't want to see us lose this, folks. Don't want to see us. What about that couple that came and spent their entire Thanksgiving day with me? You know, too many times, that's called a 12-step call. I didn't know it then. But how many times today do we, our 12-step call means dropping someone off, you know, the treatment center? But as I said, we were totally dependent upon one another, on this big book, and on meetings. That's all we had. And we would depend upon one another. All we had was one alcoholic, like they did for me, helping another alcoholic through the DTs with orange juice and honey. What a beautiful, beautiful thing. Going back to what my friend told me when I first came in, I have no idea what time it is because I don't have the watch, and there's not a watch on the wall. I start running over the bill, give me the high sign, sure I have a lady. But remember what my friend told me then in the beginning? There are going to be times when you feel that hole in your gut and the wind starts blowing through. Well, there was a time, 2 years ago, and believe me, that hole in my gut became as painful as the hole that I had there existing, and the wind was going through. But she told me, you stop right where you at. You look at your relationship with God, because therein lies the problem, and therein lies the answer. And I knew this was the problem, but I didn't know what to do about it. You see, I had taken God, the God of my understanding, and I had put this God on a self-adjusting scale. I mean, I could adjust God to approve of anything I wanted to do. God doesn't look that way. But see, I had taken the God of my understanding. I said, fine, if I wanted to do something that I knew, now I knew that probably not God would probably not approve of, and again would hurt my relationship with God incidentally. You know, anytime we do anything to injure our relationship with God, that communication we have back and forth, you know, then we're in big trouble. We're in big trouble. And I knew that I really let God have all the attributes that I wanted him to have. I mean, I could even shut God in the closet, you know, particularly wanting to see what I happened to do in that particular moment. And I realized, no, I cannot adjust God to my thinking, to my way of life. Isn't the way it works? You see, at a time when I needed God the most, and I'm talking about that accident, at a time when I needed God the most, I had made God an enemy. So I began to realize, that no, I can't do this with God. It talks in our big book, and this is one I've always liked, it talks about the relationship between the employer and the employee, that we are now having new employer. Well, I have had lots of jobs in my life, and I don't recall any job that I did not have a job description. But I had really never bothered to think too much about God's job description. But I decided that perhaps this is what I had better do. And it was in this seeking that I, as I said, the things that I have shared with you, some of the promises I have found that became so meaningful in my life, I began to realize that up until that point, I'd had a very simplistic relationship with God, and that's fine. That's fine. That's all we are capable of in the beginning. God loves me, I love God, or I think I do. But there was came a time when I had to step out of kindergarten, so to speak, and get on with my spiritual growth. Because if I didn't, I knew that I would die. So for this alcoholic, when I started my 11th step, my meditation, 11th step, for me it became necessary. Again, keep in mind, folks, it's only what this alcoholic has done. For this alcoholic, I began to realize in my meditation with God, if I was truly going to look at God and God's will for me, then perhaps this alcoholic better go to some people that knew a little bit more about it than I did. And that was back to church. Now, church, when I first came in here, was a dirty word. And some of you, I'm sure, it's still a dirty word. But I went back with the same attitude that I have at an AA meeting. And that is, you can hear a lot of things at church that you don't particularly agree with, might irritate you in any AA meetings. But if I could not reconcile what I heard at that particular time, that particular hour, with God's big book, then I just left it there. I left it there. I can't do it meeting. If I can't reconcile what you tell me, what suggestion you make to me, and if I can't reconcile it with this big book, then I kind of leave it there. And obviously, it wasn't so important. So this was necessary for me to learn of God's will for my life. All of a sudden, I'm not on dead center anymore. Once again, I feel that I am going. We have another one of our little expressions is, first things first. Now, that has come to mean to many of us, we all have different meanings, but the original meaning of first things first, it's a job to deal with here and they could talk about it, but seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all things will be added unto you. Seek first the God of your understanding and his right way to live. Not your way, not my way necessarily, but his way to live. And bring this into your life. Bring this into your program. You see, this book, it tells us again, we must go spiritually or we will die. It takes the alcoholic, it sets him on the proper path, and it sets him and heads him in the right direction for his spiritual growth. But in and of itself, it's not the complete and total end. So, seek you first the God of your understanding. Read his job description. And try to learn to walk in his ways rather than your own. Yet all things will be added unto you. That is what our motto means, first things first. When I first came to this program, I had only a couple of prayers. One of them was, please, dear God, let me know sobriety. I couldn't conceive of staying sober one day, let alone 21 years. Inconceivable to me. And the other thing was, please, oh God, let me live long enough to see these two young sons of mine grow up into productive human beings. Their lives turn into productive human beings. Because you see, we are like tornadoes going into the lives of others. I destroyed so much of the childhood of my children. I wreck havoc in their lives. Oh, how I wreck havoc. I'm not sure how we even survived some of the things that we went through. But we did. You know, one of the things I want to add. AA birthdays are so important, and I never will forget my first AA birthday. I remember getting home that night, and I'm thinking about this. All of a sudden, I was chicken to my knees. Because you see, my first AA birthday marked a couple of things. Not 1 year supply, but also marked the end of all of this surgery that I had been going through. But during this period of time, Michael and I had no visible means of support. David incidentally never came back. Probably a good thing. We had no visible means of support. I could not work. I wasn't able to work until I had been sober a couple of years. And yet Michael and I never went without food. Sometimes a little scared. We never went without food. We never went without a roof over our heads or clothes on our backs. Yet we had no visible means of support. And that took me to my knees because I began to realize, yes indeed, the Lord is my shepherd and I shall not want. I have not wanted one day that I have been in this program. I have not wanted. I've not needed. Yes, there were things I have wanted, but my needs have always been met. As He will meet your needs and your needs, regardless of what you go through. Because again, He promises this to us. But as I said, I had only two prayers. Oh, for this city, let me know sobriety. And let me live long enough to see these two young boys go into fine young manhood. Oh, He has answered these prayers so many times. I have two very fine young sons. They're both married. In fact, one of them has been married almost 20 years. I have four beautiful grandchildren. What a precious, precious gift these are. I would never have lived, you see, to even know a grandchild if it weren't for AA and people like you who told me, held out your hand to me and said, we can help you. We can help you. I would like to end, as I have ended the last several years, and that's by sharing the words of a song with you. But before I do this, I want to say in all seriousness, I've been, the last couple of weeks, I've heard laryngitis. So I probably should not even try this. But I will, and I would ask of you, perhaps, maybe you can help me along here, because my voice is pretty raspy. But I would like to share these words. So you see, I don't believe there's any words anywhere that tell it better what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. Blind, but now I see.